Why Can't I Stop? A Glimpse into Addiction. If there was one thing that I feared more than anything else, it was becoming an addict. It didn't matter what the addiction may have been, the negative connotations drilled into me were way too powerful to ignore. That is, until a chance meeting at a lecture led me to my first encounter with a recovering addict who was not just going through the motions, but had unexpectedly discovered a rich, meaningful vision of life. Now I will tell you how I ended up almost wishing to be an addict. Why Can't I Stop? A Glimpse into Addiction is a four-part documentary that examines the causes, consequences, and perceptions of addiction as relayed by a handful of recovering alcoholics, counselors, educators, and the kids in my neighborhood. In Part 1, the focus is on the evolution of the concept of addiction. Part 2 is the anatomy of an addiction. In Part 3, I look at the process of recovery, and in Part 4, life after addiction. And finally, Part 4. Life with abuse in the rearview mirror is challenging. The time spent planning, obtaining, consuming, and suffering the after effects of addictive behavior stunts progress, especially emotional growth. But the addict who chooses life tackles the challenge head on. An entire helping counseling industry has emerged to enable the addict to make that choice and then navigate a new way of life. But first, the addict has to take full responsibility for his or her life and make an intensely personal commitment to recovery. AA member Stephanie reflects.
We feel a lot of guilt and shame and remorse about the things that we've did and the people that we are or we have been. And recognizing what part drugs played in that is important in being able to alleviate some of that guilt and pain, because that guilt and pain doesn't serve us any good at that point once these actions have already done. But in terms of responsibility, like, I know for myself and like, I heard somebody say the other day, what does every addict need? Food, shelter, and someone to blame. Because it's all about not taking responsibility for ourselves, because we can't or we won't do it. Yeah, nobody can ever make me feel any specific way, and that's what I was constantly blaming people for. Like, my mantra is, like, I'm innocent. People always do things to me, and so they deserve to be punished. And so I spent a lot of years just running away from my own personal responsibility in every situation. Every time I had negative feelings, it was always somebody else's fault. And that, it's interesting, a few months ago I was thinking about responsibility and that, and in terms of, I want to be fully responsible for myself. And what that means is that I don't think I can ever control my emotions. I just don't want my emotions to control me, because I'm going to feel sadness and I'm going to feel pain and I'm going to feel guilt. And it depends on what I do with those emotions, you know. Do I pick up a drink? Do I pick up a joint? Do I verbally abuse somebody? Do I cut people out of my life? Those are all negative ways that I can deal with it. And or do I call up trusted friends and talk to them about it and try to deal with things as they come? Try to feel them instead of trying to block them out. And I think that's really fully taking responsibility, because if I can be fully responsible for the things I'm feeling and the way I manifest them, that's pretty much the grail of it all, I think. Being able to be fully responsible. And if I'm responsible for how I feel in any one situation, then I reasonably can see what part I've played.
Rick M., another AA member, discusses why he couldn't take responsibility while still in the clutches of addiction.
I was the center of the world. My dealings with people were to get them to do what I wanted. That's what the other people were in the world for. And, you know, that's obviously not a very responsible view of the world. I think a definition of recovery is, in fact, getting out of yourself enough to deal with the people in your life appropriately. To me, that's a very large part of recovery. So I think I recognized that I was irresponsible. I think I knew right from wrong. I think I knew what I should be doing. But part of the insidious part of the disease is the self-deception. You turn that away. Well, it's the other guy's fault. I'm never really to blame for anything. I mean, it's always somebody else's fault. I mean, these are all parts of the disease, the self-deception. It certainly cripples your ability to see clearly what your responsibility in life is.
Yet, there is something else that prevents addicts from making a stand. Drug and counseling educator Bill Peacock examines the reasons.
I think we're always responsible for our actions. But what then starts to cycle is a greater sense of guilt and shame and isolation, right? And what happens is some families go to the place where they may even say, for sale, you can't be part of our family anymore. You can't come in our home because you steal the drugs out of the cupboards and you're even into the cough medicine and even the Listerine isn't safe when you're, I mean that kind of craziness. Is part of what a lot of families deal with, and also the social shame. I mean, if I'm pulling in $60,000 a year and I've got a good job, a good living, last thing I want is my spouse or my children or my parents humiliating me because of their addiction, and that's a piece that, with education, if we could help people understand that recovery can also be a positive family experience.
Getting clean and sober has been called just the ante to get into the game. Then what? AA members Stephanie and Blake learned how to live with the help of AA's 12-step program.
Well, I think the strength comes from a couple of different places for me. And the first one is that never wanting to be where I was again. Like, that's an incredible motivating force in my life. Never wanting to feel that way again. Never wanting to be that way again. Never wanting to look in the mirror and honestly not know who you're looking at. Walking into a room of people and actually not knowing how to act because I've been pretending for so long that once the pretending is gone, I don't know what else is there. So that's a pretty big source of strength, is never wanting to feel that way again. And I mean, the parallel I have, or the point of comparison, is that I have the way I feel now that I get to compare, and that's a huge source of strength, is looking at how far I've come and looking at where I was before. Where else does the strength come from? A lot of it comes from the structure of recovery I've set up in my life. In that it's not this overwhelming pool of strength that I have somewhere deep down inside or that's located anywhere. It's little bits of strength that I get every day in the things that I do in my recovery. And in order for me to continue that strength that comes from outside of me, I have to continue to draw upon it. And that's going to meetings and talking to people and making new friends and reaching out. And I guess that's it.
5 meetings seems pretty excessive, replacing one addiction with another.
Yeah, it can seem excessive, but realistically, to put it really simply, is that trying to not be an active addiction anymore, the amount of time that I spent thinking about using, thinking about how I was going to get what I was going to use, actually using, being high and then feeling the after effects of it, going to 5 meetings a week, which is 5 hours, nothing compared to it. And being an active addiction means that I don't know any behaviors or patterns or ways of thinking that are comfortable to me, so that going to having 5 hours of learning a week is the least that I can do, because I don't know how to do anything at this point. I don't know how to have those healthy enough interactions. I spent however many years in school learning how to think, right? And that was full time, you know. My parents or whoever, you know, taught me from the time I was a young child about how to be, what to believe, how to act. Well, I've fucked it up somewhere along the way, and I have to relearn that. And so doing that, having 5 hours of learning a week isn't that bad. And realistically, you know, whatever works, I mean, it's not hurting me.
And for want of a better description, I talk about that underlying disease in my life as childhood, being a child, not growing up, childishness, and I speak only of myself. So I had to learn to, I didn't avail myself of the opportunity to grow up at home. I didn't listen very much. I was not a good listener. And you can grow up in public, which one does in Alcoholics Anonymous, a day at a time. It at times can be quite difficult to learn to grow into adulthood, if you like, as an adult. Then I'm still in the process of growing up. Like the old question, the funny question used to be, who do you want to be when you grow up? And I want to be me.
The addicts I interviewed all had one thing in common. They had decided to pursue life. They had found meaning in their life and were living with gusto, not wasting a minute. I have come to appreciate what these people have, and the part of me that suffers in an existential hell feels twangs of jealousy. These people are truly grateful for what their lives have become. As Khalil Gibran says so beautifully in The Prophet, your joy is your sorrow unmasked, and the selfsame well from which your laughter rises was oftentimes filled with your tears. And how else can it be? The deeper that sorrow carves into your being, the more joy you can contain. The counselor is a key ingredient in recovery. Their mission to help addicts come to terms with their demons also carries a heavy responsibility. Many counselors are in recovery themselves. I was a bit skeptical. I mean, how can you help someone else if you are screwed up yourself? Drug and counseling educators Joe Ellis and Bill Peacock disagreed.
That's a tough one, but the word you used, be there, is key and critical. And on the road to recovery, or on the road in recovery, however you want to word that, I think the initial piece of the initial work of the counselor is to be there. Now, they may not have the skills, abilities, training to work with some of these really deep-seated issues, and you may need to sort of work with somebody, refer somebody to someone who can do that kind of work, but you can't even get to the referral unless you're there with the person. And this may sound a bit simplistic, again, it's not meant to be, but the honesty, the openness, the valuing of the other person that you're working with can go a tremendous way in getting at some of those. It may not get to the explanation, it may not get to sort of the wherefores and whys and the therapeutic pieces and the movement along that therapeutic milieu or whatever you want to call that, but it breaks the ice, it gets there. And that's where the warmth, understanding, being there in the moment with the person is so key and critical. And that's where sometimes when we abandon our clients, and I don't mean abandoned by walking away, I mean abandoned by not making that emotional connection, withholding judgment, valuing them in their particular circumstance at that point in time, knowing full well that at some point in their recovery they're going to need to deal with those issues, and you may need to be the one that works with them around dealing with those issues. But that's key and critical. And I think that's not higher order kinds of work, I don't think. Those are things and skills that can be trained, and we can work with students around that. We are imperfect beings, and there's no assumption on anyone's part that we get people to be perfect.
I don't have a problem with us working with people who aren't there. In fact, our expectation is not that they're perfect creatures. And one of the things that we do is basically say, you know what, you got to understand your own crap and deal with your own crap before we can let you loose on the world to try and dive into theirs. So it's like, doesn't mean you have to. So some of the good pieces is you're empathic towards the other folks because they, like you, are suffering. The other huge piece we teach, and over and over and over again, is boundaries and the transference and counter-transference stuff. So if Joe's going through something and it paralleled stuff that I went through, it doesn't mean he's going what I went through, right? So that's the piece that's really important. So we teach the appropriate techniques. We teach the capacity to do the self-reflection, but we also teach the ability to not own the other person's journey.
That's right. And to recognize that, and it, you can't see this, but one of the things that I do with my class is I stand and I've got one hand in front of me and I've got one hand behind my back. And one of the things that we do when we're working with our clients is we're juggling their issues with the one hand in front of me. And that's open and it's above board and it's there. But at the same time, we may be, with my other hand behind my back, juggling our own stuff in relation to some of those same issues. And that's okay. That's part of humanness, of being real. The problems become is when that hand that's behind my back becomes in front of me and some of my stuff begins to get juggled in with some of my client's stuff. And that's where, you know, boundaries, supervision, awareness, self-understanding, all those kinds of things become so key and critical.
No matter how good counselors' intentions are, the recovery industry is big bucks, and not all are in it because they care. Battles are fought against giant multinationals and even governments more than willing to manipulate societal values in favor of their product. I would like to place the blame on capitalism, but that would be too easy. Bill and Joe?
All kinds of educational programs that are established. We have programs that will go into the elementary schools as well as into the high schools where they're trying to teach positive information about the impact of substance. One of the unfortunate worst campaigns that ever was marketed was Just Say No. I mean, that was just a total disaster. But the intent was there. The intent was to try and say, you know what, when approached about it, this is how you can respond.
And it's tough because, I mean, one of the issues, again, is if you look at prevention, what are you hoping to prevent? Are you hoping to prevent use? Are you hoping to prevent incidents of new use? Are you hoping to prevent problematic use and those kinds of things? We've talked a lot about we don't really know 100% on what that's all about in relation to, you know, prevention. We know, for example, people know, and you can ask any 11-year-old about cigarettes. And they was, oh my God, why would anybody smoke? You know, we know that it does this, this, and this. There's no way.
Hold up. Let's see if Joe is correct. I asked 11-year-old kids in my neighborhood about addiction.
Addiction is something that if you're stuck on to beer or alcohol and you can't get off it.
Addiction is where you get dependent on a substance. And if you don't have that substance, then your body won't work as well. If they like something and they do it and they keep on want to do it, like smoking, for a fact.
People can get drunk and if they drive, then they can get in accidents and kill people.
Do you think people can stop being addicted if they wanted to?
If they really put their mind to it.
Oh yes, they can stop being addicted if they wanted to because like if they had enough and they didn't want to do it anymore, they would just stop.
If you don't see that stuff or and you don't eat it and you don't want to talk about it.
They could probably get drunk and probably just go around with a knife and start killing people.
You can get addicted to tobacco. You can get addicted to Twizzlers, food. You can get addicted to ice cream, stuff like that.
People who are addicted to smoking, maybe they should smarten up and stop.
Why is that?
Because people, you can die from smoking.
Talk to them again when they're 14 and 15. And we know there's that transition piece, there's that experimental piece that kids go through, that we all go through around things. So we just because we know it doesn't necessarily mean it changes their behavior. Sexually transmitted disease is another one. We know that you know safe sex practices are really, really important besides the issues of pregnancies, but the issues of STDs and HIV and AIDS. Yet people still get STDs, they still get HIV, they still get AIDS through that particular process. So to have that utopic kind of thing, gee, I wish we had a magic wand to go swoosh and it wouldn't be here, would be nice. But that will never happen. We'll always have mental illness. We'll always have people with addiction problems. We'll always have people who are marginalized in our society. So the issue becomes, A, I think, how do we deal with those folks? And B, how do we educate and make people aware such that we marginalize less people, for example, than what we did 10 years ago? That we include people more than exclude people. And how do we do that? Well, part of that is by modeling. Part of that is by small communities and neighborhoods getting together, educational institutions having positive policies in practice and in place, teachers, people who are in their own recovery, mums and dads, everyday folk model a whole bunch of things. And I think that's happening more and more. I mean, you talked a lot about sort of how people do things and model things, Rick, and how our society's changing in relation to drinking and driving and cigarette smoking and those kinds of things. It's not going to happen overnight. We didn't get to the place we are now, you know, over the last 4 months.
Looks like progress is being made. Recovering addicts are fueling this progress. Who better? They've been there and back. I ask my newfound friends, Blake, Jean, Doug, and Rick, what it's all about.
I think they're here.
Well, I know why I'm here, and one of the main reasons that I'm here is to help the alcoholic that still suffers. I'm here to help. If somebody hears the result of what you're doing, and that is the day that their denial, they realize denial is not a river in Egypt, if you like, and they click and say, hey, maybe I'm an alcoholic, and maybe I should do something about it before it does something about me. Then, everything that's been done here will be worthwhile.
But I have had a good life, and I would like to share that with anyone else that needs it. Not because I'm a rescuer. I can't. Uh-huh. I cannot, even one of my own children, make them go to AA, even if I thought they needed it. But I have a responsibility to help anyone, whoever it might be. And in doing that, I maintain my sobriety.
It's not something that I've come along and said, I want the world to hear this message, whatever the message is, because I realize that anybody that's listening to this show, each person's going to take something different away from it, good or bad. But I'm here because I want people to know that are suffering, that there is a better way of life. I was diagnosed with mental conditions. And today, I don't feel the need to delve into those things anymore.
At the situation of trying to do something about my life, my greatest fear was that I would put everything into it and not get the job done. That was an incredibly intense fear. But I took the plunge anyway. And the result was I had no optimism. I had no thought that there would be help, that there would be a better way. I think I understand that you only get to keep what you give away. I just want to say that I had a first life. It ended the day I stopped drinking. I have a second life, and it is so incredibly richer that I would hope people would take that same plunge and investigate.
Generations to come may face new addictions, but their sources likely will remain the same.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Oh. Oh, actually, computer, internet. Computer games and internet addiction is even greater. In fact, casinos have figured out, I mean, again, multi-billion-dollar organizations, they've realized that you need to change the screens, not for those of us who are in our 40s and 50s, but for those of us who are in our early teens. So they want, casinos want those screens to replicate the thrill level that our kids are getting so that they will be more attracted to come in and drop their paychecks.
Yeah, that's a major issue. I think our next generation will be talking about alcohol, illicit drug use and those kinds of things, but this whole gambling addiction piece coming up with the next generation growing up on computer games, the quick fix, all that kind of stuff,
TVs, Zoom,
sedentary issues as well. We're going to see some real spillovers in that. I mean, you take a look at that gambling in the sense of the lotto lines and the sports betting and all that. I mean, I remember growing up when my dad came home one time with the Irish sweepstakes ticket.
The hidden Irish sweepstakes.
It was hidden because you had to meet Guido somewhere to buy this ticket, and he would, you know, shh, don't tell anybody where I got it from, you know, because it's illegal, kind of thing. And to the point where we are today, where there's like $35 million and everybody spends all kinds of money, and kids are just going to continue to move into that, and how much of their income will be related to that whole thing. And it's got nothing to do with substance use. It's the same kind of process, thinking process. Right. There's some neurochemistry stuff involved with that as well. But that whole generation is going to be really interesting.
There is some good news, though. We have made considerable progress with today's addictions, especially alcohol. Educators Joe Ellis and Bill Peacock sum it up.
Some good news is there are folks that actually want to hear about this story, where 15 years ago, nobody wanted to hear about addictions. It was back alley stuff. Mm-hmm. There wasn't training programs for people to go into this kind of work at all. It wasn't seen as an admirable profession. People who were addicts weren't viewed as valued human beings. I mean, they were viewed as people to write off. And so as we grow in our compassion and empathy and realize the great human worth of each individual and the potential for recovery and living positive lives, I mean, it's absolutely huge. And Joe and I have witnessed the road to recovery from some people that you would just never believe. They should be dead by now. And not only have, should have been dead by now, but instead of being dead, is able to commit his life and no longer seen as kind of like the scourge of society, but a positive influence, a positive role model, being able to tell your story without feeling humiliated and embarrassed and being welcomed and accepted. I think those are all good newses.
Mm-hmm. I would agree with that. The good news, again, as you say, people are talking. It's out of the closet, so to speak. It's not as much in the closet. And there's more of a tolerance. There's more of an acceptance. There's more of an understanding. There, in fact, is behavioral change. You talked about moving from understanding to behavioral change. There is behavioral change now. You know, I've seen people actually take somebody's keys away from them. You know, and 10 years ago, that would not have happened. There were people that designated driver, for example, in the drinking and driving stuff, and it started off as, oh, God, it's my turn tonight. Nah, nah, nah. But now it's like it's accepted. I see that in our youth and in students that sure, there's still going to be a group. There will always be a group. But the vast majority look upon it as very responsible, regardless of whether they're in that age stage stuff or whatever. And that's a real positive to see that. A real positive to see that you know, some of the illegal drug usage in some sectors is going down in some of the areas. Marijuana is up a little bit, and some other areas are up, but there's been a bit of a shift. There's good news in the sense of some of the harm reduction programs that are out there as well. So reducing harm, reducing problematic issues around needle exchanges for raves and ecstasy use, the ability to check your tabs out beforehand and make sure there's no poisons in there so that in fact you're going to get the buzz, you're going to get the effect you want, but you're not going to end up being killed by it or having some real serious consequences. Now, the moral majority may say they shouldn't be doing that to begin with, but it's kind of nice that I can get it checked out.
Good news is people are able to get methadone and not feel totally humiliated about going in for their swig into the pharmacy and go back out and keep working at their jobs, right? Good news. Personally, the best good news is my 23-year-old son will not drink and drive.
And that concludes Why Can't I Stop? A Glimpse into Addiction. For more info or copies of the broadcast, email liberationckcu@canada.com. Why Can't I Stop? Was produced and narrated by Faisal Musa. Thanks to Alana McDougall, Jeremy Bell, Matthew Crozier, and the kids in my neighborhood. Music was composed by Colin McDougall.